Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
What say you, Richard Pellet Murdoch? Are you guilty or not guilty of the felonies wherein you stand indicted?
Not guilty.
How shall you be tried?
By God and my country.
The exact time when Paul and Maggie Murdoch were murdered.
At the end of the investigation, it was obvious.
I'm not here to work with them. Okay?
And the whole point is to have this not fall into the wrong hands. This case is unique, it's unprecedented in South Carolina history.
Dead wrong. If you think I've come in here and told this jury something because of money, when we're talking about two people who were brutally murdered, then you're headed in the wrong direction.
Do you think he did it?
I don't have an opinion. I don't have the benefit of the materials you have.
We are Unsolved South Carolina, the Murdochs, Murder, Money, and Mystery. This is our podcast. I'm Ann Emerson. I'm here with our exclusive legal analyst, Charlie Condon. He's also South Carolina's former attorney general. And we have our executive producer, Drew Trippier. And we have Max Harrison, chief photog, WCIV. He's running the boards, taking care of production, fielding questions. So please let us know if you have any questions and take part in the poll. Max, where do you get the poll?
It's on Twitter.
So please keep an eye out for the poll. We do it every night. Just want to know what you think. Starting off, that was Ronnie Crosby. And he came back as a rebuttal witness in today's testimony. This is after we've had the prosecution's case. This is after the defense rested. The prosecution was allowed to come back. Why are they allowed to come back, Charlie? I think everybody would kind of like to know why.
That's a great question. As we noted yesterday, I thought it was a good day for the defense in their case. And by the way, I should mention, if there was any confusion in the verbiage yesterday about the testimony of John Marvin Murdoch, I did want to say, just to clarify, that thought that he was a great witness for the defense and did think that he was straightforward and told the information as he thought it to be truthfully, and just thought he was just a very effective witness. And any confusion on that, I just wanted to clarify that. But getting into what happened today, you heard from the leadoff witness, and each witness, I thought, as the day wore on, and it culminated, as we'll talk about, with Dr. Ken Kinsey being directly examined by the Attorney General of South Carolina, Alan Wilson. I thought they ended really strongly. And so procedurally, state goes first, they have to prove their case. The judge okayed the case to go on. There was no directed verdict. Now we're in the defense case. Yesterday, they closed their case, so the state gets to rebut. And this got to be a little bit of a tension there with the defense, in that the rules are such that you only need to rebut what was newly brought up by the defense in their case. And the defense claimed that the judge was allowing too many witnesses, but he said he was going to rule on a case-by-case basis, and he ended up letting them all testify.
Well, there were six witnesses. We heard there could be up to seven, but he allowed all of the witnesses to come forward. So this first one, Ronnie Crosby, why did they have Ronnie Crosby come back? Do you know?
Wow. Well, you heard what he had to say, right? It was just really powerful in terms of, you know, we've talked about this a bit, about Mrs. Drew's field of expertise on hog hunting. Yeah, and
we got another day of hog hunting.
We'll limit the testimony or the comments about hog hunting. But Ronnie was very clear on you can kill those hogs during the day. And so, but he went into a lot of other areas. And as you heard from the sound clip, he was challenged very strongly by defense attorney Dick Harpootlian. And it was a moment.
It was a moment. And he was pretty much saying, you are impugning my integrity. I think that's what I read. We've got another clip from Ronnie. Did you have something to add before we go there?
Hog hunting, going to stay away from that, or is that too controversial?
No,
I thought Ronnie, and I think Mark Ball as well. I think the overarching point of getting them back up there, because not a lot of new ground was covered with either of them. The overarching point I felt was pretty clear. One of the last questions Creighton Waters asked both of them is, did Alec Murdoch lie to your face for years?
Right.
And they both said, yeah, he did. It's evident, and they never suspected it.
Basically, but I thought it was very powerful because they supposedly thought they knew him, and here they're here to say that, no, we did not know them. He came across quite well for the state.
Yeah, and I thought it was, I don't know how effective, but I thought it was smart of Dick Harpootlian to attack Ronnie Crosby and to attack his motivations and to plant that seed of doubt. I'd let that speak for itself, but whether it worked or not, whether it is going to plant that seed of doubt, but I thought he needed to do it because it's a perfectly reasonable thing for someone to think is you're just up here because you're mad because he cost you money.
Well, let's play this other clip from Ronnie Crosby because it was quite a way to sort of kick off the day of rebuttal
first
witnesses.
Witness, it woke you up, didn't it?
It did. It completely did on both sides.
Yes, it was a back and forth.
And if you're implying that I would come in here and somehow shade truth in any way because of that, I would take high offense with that, Mr. Harpootlian.
I'm concerned about your high offense. Are you angry at him for stealing your money?
I have no feeling one way or the other.
You don't have any feeling about Alec Murdoch betraying you and stealing your money.
That was just vintage Dick Harpootlian, in my opinion. We know that he can use his voice. He barks when he's ready to tell what he wants everybody to hear. He told me, and I think it's actually in the intro for our podcast, he told me, I'm not here to be your friend.
Right. Yeah, that's Dick. By the way, I did think they established, which was the purported purpose of both those attorneys testifying, in that you can kill hogs during the day because they made a point that you couldn't. It had to be at night, so therefore there wouldn't have been the weapons in the golf cart. That the state's theory. So that was established. But these side moments, it got to be something. And I must say, it was quite the electric moment in the courtroom. It really was.
Just goes to show how much I know with Mark Ball and Ronnie Crosby. Of course, I don't own nearly as much land as either of those two gentlemen do and have to deal with it. But it's a niche problem for certain areas of certain places. I plan to have I'm going to plug my own social media here. I'm going to put together a whole Twitter thread on feral pigs, wild hogs, and the problems they cause, nuisances they've become. But, generally speaking, why do they have the night vision or thermal scopes on the rifles? They are, I think, generally speaking, easier to hunt at nighttime with just because they're little less wary and they thrive under the cover of darkness to be able to move about. But when you're operating I'm just going to make assumptions about Ronnie and Mark Ball here. I'm willing to bet that they have a lot of cultivated land as far as crops, improvements for food plots, for wildlife, deer, turkey, quail, whatever is legal game to hunt here in South Carolina. They probably have invested in improvements on that property, and not only would it attract natural game, it would attract wild pigs,
right?
Because I mean they want to eat all those same things that the corn and different types of grain and forage and browse that you have for these game animals that they're investing a lot of their money in to have their own little not little but private game preserves. They're a problem for not just those types of, but any cultivated land, any farmer, any agricultural venture like that. Yeah. Hogs are a huge problem.
Yeah. And by the way, I thought it was kind of interesting about this case, and we had so many layers in this case, but this whole hunting culture, so to speak.
Right.
I mean, wow, we've had so much testimony about the deer hunting, the duck hunting, the killing the hogs, and it's just a lot throughout the whole case, which is a bit of a surprise to me.
Well, and one thing that I was thinking from someone that doesn't hog hunt very often, I have to admit, but I thought it was interesting, about just thinking about the geography down here. every piece of land is different, right? Mm-hmm. So Moselle property is probably very different from the Greenfields property mm-hmm. that John Mark, no, maybe not. Well, maybe kind of same. All right. But like swamp land, that's where these hogs live, right?
To a large extent,
so
yes.
I guess what I was trying to say is you don't know how much swamp land necessarily. I mean, you can bet there's some, mm-hmm. but you don't know how much is on each plot of land that we're talking about. So there's also that subjectivity that I was seeing about. If we wanted to go down the hog hunting rabbit hole right now, which we just did, I think.
To that end, think about if you're trying...
Next metaphor, rabbit hole, right?
If you're trying to visualize... If you're trying to visualize where you'd most likely find feral pigs, wild hogs, whatever you want to call them, imagine a map of South Carolina's rivers. And generally speaking, wild hog populations are going to closely align with watersheds and watercourses okay. in the state.
Got it.
And then beyond that, and especially here in the lower part of the state, the coastal plain, that's everywhere. That could be, we have things here, there's water everywhere. Even if it's just a little trickle, a little bog, a little something, a little pond out in the middle of a forest, it doesn't have to be swampland for there to be swampy areas. And any water source with thick timber, there's going to be hogs there. So that's generally speaking where you're going to find them. And this has been Hog Hunting 101 with Charlie and Ann and Drew. And thank you for joining
us
tonight.
We're going to get back to the Murdoch murder trial. We just can't help it. It just keeps on coming back. And this is the last time, I swear. But Ronnie Crosby goes... Carpooling goes, you're not an expert in hog hunting. And he goes, well, I think I am. I've killed thousands of these animals. Right. And the reason we're laughing, because we're not making light, obviously, of a murder trial. Everybody in the courtroom, including, I think, the judge, you couldn't help. But there are moments.
Everyone did.
It was just one of those things that you're going to look back at and think, good grief. But we are going to move on. One of the things that I did want to talk about, which we all kind of scratched our heads a little bit, why is the cell phone expert coming back to throw his phone around? Did anybody understand?
We have a different opinion on this.
I know. Well, I decided I'm going to do it because this is my personal phone, so no one at the station can get mad at me. But what are you? They were just taking it. It was turned off. This is going to go off camera.
He's a cell phone expert.
Okay, so it's off. Okay, the race to wake expert, I think, is what he was.
Yeah.
Hold on. Okay, it didn't come
go.
On.
There you go.
There you go.
Yeah.
Is that proof of what? Tell me.
I don't know. Here was my take on it. I felt like the ground gained, I think, was a net positive for the state. I think it was net positive because what?
Oh yeah, the state. I mean, don't you think the defense had a total defense of like, hey, you couldn't have thrown that phone because you would have been able to prove by your electronic gizmos mm-hmm. and data that he didn't, and the state shot that to pieces by this
2 day.
We're kind of laughing about it because I do think that, I mean, certainly set the stage here. You had this trained expert from different county, Charleston County, mm-hmm. and he apparently mm-hmm. got involved with helping, I'm assuming, the solicitor's office out of Beaufort, out of the 14th Circuit, mm-hmm. how he got involved. But anyhow, he was qualified as an expert in cell phone forensics.
And they made a big deal of that when they brought him back up there, that he was an expert in cell phone forensics. Sorry, y'all. We're a little bit punchy tonight. So they brought him up there, and they qualified him as an expert in cell phone forensics, and they went through this whole long spiel again that we've heard so many times in this trial. And what are your qualifications? And then what it amounted to is they had this expert witness, a forensics expert. He sat in a room all weekend and threw his phone around. And
for 2 days.
Case, but think about this. I mean, the defense qualified him as an expert.
Yes. And not in an expert in throwing your phone around, which then set the defense off. Like Phil Barber got up there on a holy mission, and he's like, "So you're telling us that he moved to have all of Paul McManigal's testimony as an expert stricken because he was not an expert in the subject matter to what he was testifying to.
Which was throwing your phone
around and the mechanics and inner workings of race to wake.
I mean, really, I shouldn't be laughing because this is a murder trial, but I did think it was brilliant by this. I know you and I disagree on this, but he got qualified as an expert. Judge Newman said you didn't object. And it is true. I suppose, really probably an eighth grader could have done this. I agree with that. But think with the evidence he got in. He was able to show me at least how the defendant could have pulled this off.
That's the net positive.
Yeah.
He got it in. I just, but it's such a, like he didn't. to the defense's point, he didn't document any of this. He didn't create a report. Yeah. He didn't video himself doing it. He didn't write anything down. But the logical rebuttal to that is, well, Mr. Harpootly and Mr. Griffin, Mr. Barber, where are all the reports from your expert witnesses? Yeah. They didn't have any either.
They could have had it's called a sur rebuttal. They could have rebutted to the defense's rebuttal. And I know they had someone throw that phone at lunchtime.
Yeah.
I have to think that.
And like, now we're all wondering if during jury deliberations we're going to be hearing them throwing their phone around.
It's a fact now, I think, established for the jury. And so it really, I thought, helped the state because I was troubled by that. I thought, well, wouldn't his phone wake up? And he said basically nine times out of ten when he did it like a Frisbee, it didn't turn on. What's it called? Rise to wake?
Yeah.
And if you tumbled it, raised to wake. If you tumbled it, didn't he say like half the time?
But yes. If you pick up your phone like this, it's supposed to turn on, so which it does.
Yeah.
Just like that.
For them to get that, I don't know. I know we disagree on that. I do think the form may not have been like perfect, but the substance was, I thought, terrific.
Yeah. Again, net positive.
I think he could have.
Worth it.
And I actually think, I mean, to me, if I were the judge, which of course I'm not, I think you could have anyone testify to that by saying,
sure,
I threw my phone. Then it might have been a little more dicey because they would have gotten into maybe the engineering aspects of this thing. Maybe it wouldn't have come in. So I thought it was just brilliant by the city. Got him qualified as an expert. Judge Newman said you didn't object. And here we are. Over the weekend, I threw my phone. Didn't he say like for hours?
Yes. Hours.
Friday and Saturday.
Mm-hmm. So it was, I thought, good evidence for the state.
So another thing that the state had the opportunity to bring back one of their key witnesses, really key witnesses. This is Dr. Ken Kinsey. He's also the chief deputy in the sheriff's office over in Orangeburg, right up the road. Mm-hmm. Has a very good rapport already from the first time he testified with the jurors. Mm-hmm. So I was sort of watching that. Now, this was his opportunity to look at what was presented by the defense for how Paul was shot at the feed room. There's the big controversy here are two points, really, in my opinion. It's not just the fact that the defense's expert was saying that it was a contact shot to the head. Mm-hmm. It was also the angle of which he had to shoot in order to...
Right, and the two-shooter theory, too.
And the two-shooter theory, mm-hmm. exactly. And it was... So we're going to play this clip. If you're watching this on the live stream, you can see it as well. But the Attorney General, Alan Wilson, our sitting Attorney General, did this rebuttal witness. He was the direct on this rebuttal witness of Dr. Ken Kinsey. And so they actually acted it out using, once again, pulling out the gun.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
The defense agreed with the assessment that Paul stood there for a moment, bleeding down his injured left arm, and he slowly walked toward the door.
Okay, and what does the shooter do?
The shooter's coming in the door.
And then what does the shooter do?
He shoots Paul in the back of the head after he passes him.
Okay, and then shoots Paul in the back of the head like this, and where does the blood spatter go?
The blood spatter, the pellet defects, And one that I didn't know about that the expert collected was in the door frame at the top of the door.
Well, that was incredible. The way they acted it out is actually very, I mean, once again, definitely feel like I'm a visual learner. It helped me. What'd y'all think?
Yeah, I want to say, too, in interest of full disclosure, I mean, when I was Attorney General, Alan was an intern for me, and I've known him for years. I'm a huge supporter of his, so, I mean, please know that. But I did think that it was, I think, a bit of a risk, right? He was been at the table for weeks and weeks now, and to take the last witness, which is probably one of the key, if not the key witnesses for the state in a high-profile case. But I thought he was just lights out in his direct examination, very powerful. And I thought particularly effective was the demonstration in the doorway with how the weapon could not have been pointed. And he got permission from the witness and to...
And he never really put it right in his head. I was kind of waiting for that moment. And he brought the gun down next to him.
Right.
Which was the smart thing to do, I think, in light of what we know, that would have been a little too much. But yes, I just thought it was very effective because, once again, you were trying to understand. Until he did that, I didn't totally see what he was saying about the shooter would have had to come around into the feed room. I didn't really get that until I saw Attorney General Wilson do that.
Right.
I agree.
It was excellent, excellent, excellent point. And it was... a very non-technical, non-mumbo-jumbo way of explaining what they had been talking about for so long. And one of the big points that was made in all of this was the void, the blood spatter void, right? Where there was the absence of blood spatter, like a line of demarcation, a clear line where there is no blood, and then after which there's tons of blood. And... the defense's expert tried to make the point, Palmbach, I think was his name, Tim Palmbach, tried to make the point that, that could easily be explained by the shooter standing there. And then you have two grown men go stand in a doorway together and you see how absurd it is. You see how absurd it is. And yeah, while one theory is technically probably possible, what's the more reasonable and plausible theory, which is that the reason that blood spatter void was there is that Paul's body was in the way and beside the door, not that the shooter somehow got past him and walked behind him to get that angle to then account for. And what he really did, and I brought this point up yesterday's episode, which just how implausible and absurd to me it seemed, the whole theory of the shot went into Paul's body with such force that it blew straight back up the barrel of the gun and possibly injured the gunman and then lodged into the door frame and dented the door and damaged the door, which just does not.
Drew, I swear you channeled King Kinsey. When you said that last night, you basically said the argument that Dr. Kinsey used on the sand. Did you hear that?
Same thing, yeah.
I mean, I was listening to that and I was like, that is, because you're a hunter.
Right.
You understand how pellets work.
Yes. Kinsey elaborated, he touched on this point a little bit. One thing that you might have with steel shot, which is what we're talking about here, what the state believes was the fatal wound to Paul was from a number two steel birdshot load, waterfowl load, out of a shotgun. Steel pellets they're very, very, very hard. And Kinsey touched on this, is when you're advised when you're at a target range or often at shooting ranges, they use steel targets. They use a little steel plate and you are typically shooting a lead projectile, a lead bullet. And when that lead hits that steel, it flattens out into a pancake disc and falls straight to the ground. Whether that's a little tiny BB-sized lead pellet or it's an actual bullet from like a rifle or a pistol, lead is going to flatten out and it's just going to fall straight to the ground. Steel, bouncing off steel, is a danger. And steel, when it bounces off steel, will bounce back. And you're advised not to shoot steel shot at close range on a when you're using steel targets on a professional shooting range or an at-home shooting range, because of the it's like the trampoline effect he's talking about. But we're not talking about someone shooting steel into steel here. We're talking about them shooting steel into the human anatomy, tissue, bone. It's not going to bounce back like that. It just does. It's physics. It doesn't work like that. And Kinsey even threw out a statistic. He said it's like 8 or 10. The rebound of a blowback is like 8 or 10% of the force of what the actual shot was. So if the shot is propelled at however many hundreds of feet per second, over 1,000 feet per second. I think he said it was like 1,400 feet per second is what that number two waterfowl load is, the muzzle velocity is coming out of the barrel. It's only going to come back at 8 to 10% of that, which is not enough for it to just, it's just not enough for it to lodge, cause the damage that it did. And it was just completely anecdotally and scientifically, it is completely just absurd and illogical. And I think Kinsey did a good job of articulating that from both perspectives, talking to the layperson and talking in terms of what the science and the literature supports.
Yeah, I agree. But I thought his 8 to 10% was on the blood stuff, but regardless, I thought he was very powerful. I mean, I thought...
You're right.
I think he won the day for the state on that point.
Well, and because it's a he said, she said, or a he said argument, you know, as we've been going through the prosecution, the defense, I really feel like the prosecution and the defense are giving two different arguments.
Aren't they?
And that the jury's going to have to decide who they believe.
Yeah, and Dr. Reimer, what do you think about her, too? Because she was...
Well, and we have a clip to play, which is really good, too, because Dr. Reimer came back. Reimer?
I think it's... I've heard it mostly pronounced Reimer. I will say that Ken Kinsey dovetailed very nicely with her, and she said him, and maybe we should have played her first, but strong in her own right. And I think another example of Dick Harpootlian getting somebody riled up. She wanted to tell him about himself today.
Did you see her body language?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Looked like she's ready to tangle.
She does not like to be told that she's wrong.
Especially when
she knows she's right. Right. And I think you definitely felt that. This is, she said it over and over again, this is her place of expertise. This is what she does. And she knows what she knows. Basically, I wanted to set up the clip just a little bit and also to let you know that there is a strong language, because she's a pathologist and she's talking about some very strong subject matter here. We're talking about Paul again. The reason they're trying to nail this down is because if it was a contact shot, it had to be shot from a specific angle that would have taken us into a very different direction for the defense. She is very clear about what she did as a pathologist with Paul when she examined him. And she says this is no contact shot. So let's hear what she has to say.
20-plus years of experience doing autopsies and seeing contact shotgun wounds to the head, which are associated with massive gas expansion in the skull. This entire face, he would have had tears. The, you know, eyes would have been either hanging down or lost, blown out. There's no way that these features are consistent with a contact shotgun wound to the head.
There you go.
Yeah, I thought it was established both with her testimony and Dr. Kinsey went through his experience with these, and it was gruesome, his direct experience with seeing gunshot wounds to the head. And, you know, pardon the purse, I'll never forget the day as part of, I think it was training for prosecuting cases in general. I had to sit through as I recall, it might have been a full day. It was a long period of time in which it showed you pictures of the damage done through different weapons. And really sticks with you. But he had personal experience with it and going to crime scenes. And he said, didn't he say someone killed themselves right in front of him with a shotgun in the head? Mm-hmm. So I thought it was very powerful. Mm. Basically, they're saying, hey, the damage to his brain would have been quite different if it were a contact wound. Both of them said that, and I thought they were very believable.
I thought Ken, coming off of Dr. Reimer, she was I think that's the word I would use, is unflappable. She was undaunted by it, because Dick Harpootlian came after her, and it wasn't quite as impassioned as his assault on, and I use I use assault euphemistically. It wasn't a literal sense, but he really came hard after Ronnie Crosby with a much different tone. Right. But it was more persistence and doggedness that he came after Dr. Reamer with, and she met him force for force, and could not. And while she conceded yes, different pathologists might have differing opinions on what they saw. She is the one who did the full autopsy. She is the one who viewed the full picture. And it's important to note, we've heard from several witnesses now from the defense has called, they were not always given the full picture. They were given selective pieces of information from the defense from which to base their opinions.
Yeah.
The
defense's expert witnesses have testified they weren't given full case reports.
They only got parts from the state, not from the defense.
And her point was, if you had seen what I had seen, you put your hands on the bodies, you'd taken this whole thing into context, you would have come to no other conclusion. And some of the reasoning that these experts, Eisenstadt and Palmbach, used to make their determinations and their opinions are not based on the full picture, and they're a bit dubious for other reasons, scientifically.
Yeah, and by the way, I thought that, kudos again to General Wilson, I thought, did you notice how he would not use those graphic pictures with his expert? And I thought that was some really good taste, because the jurors have seen enough of it. And I can remember that day I spent, I can't remember if it was several hours of the full day, but it just sticks with you. So I really had the feeling from these jurors that, boy, we've had enough of the pictures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's no need to do that. It was a very good call, I thought. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and what also I found interesting about our pathologist today was that she did not make any bones, did not apologize really for not doing certain things. Mm-hmm. You know, Dick's job is to poke holes in the way she did this autopsy report, and one of them was that there was no brain x-ray to see how many pellets were in there. I just liked the way she was able to stay on track, and she did not she didn't make any bones about if she didn't do something. And I thought that was an effective part, and that's why I bring it up, is like I found it very effective that she wasn't apologizing for what she didn't do, because she obviously, if you've done 5,500 autopsies, you have a method. Mm-hmm. So I just thought that was interesting. For good or for bad or for worse, it was nice to hear some witnesses up there that really knew what they were doing.
Yeah, and she did say that in hindsight she wishes she'd have taken more pictures and done more. She said, and she was emphatic, she didn't need to. It could have avoided a lot of what the strife in her life and the strain in her life from having to come up here and do this over and over again, and the time commitment. But she felt she was on solid footing with it.
So. Well, and I have a question from a viewer that had reached out to me. They said, there's been a great discussion about the sloppy sled work and the Murdoch murders. Do you think the sloppy investigative work was initially purposeful to help cover up for the powerful Alec Murdoch in case he were charged with these murders? I know that's sort of a loaded question, but I think it's interesting to talk about whether or not that is what is being used by the defense on some level, or the state on some level. How is that the idea that there are issues with the sled investigation, how does that sort of wind its way into this?
I think neither side wants to touch that with a 10-foot pole. Because and you think of it first from the defense's perspective, they can't have it both ways. They can't have it be that sled did a terrible job, and also sled did a terrible job because our client was privileged and got special treatment, that we've made a big point of trying to say that he actually didn't get that kind of treatment, and that he was just Joe Blow every man who happened to make tens of millions of dollars. And for the state, you're you don't have a case, if you're the state, you don't have the case that you have right now without SLED and the Colleton County Sheriff's Office. And I have, you know, been pretty forthright in just my assessment that I think there were missed opportunities, and probably if they're looking at it objectively, SLED would say some failures in how they did the case. But that doesn't outweigh the totality of what they did come up with and what they have been able to prove to a large extent, which what they have shown, from a casual observer's standpoint, I think the evidence suggests what the state suggests at this point, and that the state has no case without what the work SLED has done. And neither of them wants to go there, but I'm not going to speculate on it. I can't, because the idea is out there, and it's certainly
I think I hear where you're coming from, but I'm completely confident. And it's interesting for me because I have an active law practice, criminal defense practice, and as these SLED agents came up, I thought, I had a case with him or her, with mostly, actually, there's several agents, and I've dealt with them before. I'm completely confident that the agents had full integrity in this investigation, 100% confident. Now, I do think this may have happened. If you step back from this, they get this call, and I do think that there might have been some, in hindsight, undue deference given to Alec Murdoch, because it was just unthinkable, right? Mm-hmm. They show up there like son and wife, and so there might have been a little bit in hindsight, they might have regretted the deference not going into the house and seizing the home and treating him as a suspect from the first moment. Yeah, and not searching Almeida. I think that might have happened, but that was a misstep. I don't think anything to do with any sort of plan to help him or anything related to character. But I think it might have been the setting that occurred. And also, we need to talk about this a little bit too, because you had the local sheriff recuse himself, but you did have, correct me if I'm wrong, but the local circuit solicitor, who I think highly of, but he was there, wasn't he, like the next morning or pretty soon on the scene?
Mm-hmm. With Dylan Hightower.
Yeah, to help his assistant.
Facilitate, right.
Well, I think he was there, don't you think, to help find the killers of his assistant's...
Yeah.
So the mindset, I think, initially was, which, it's again, I'm sure they regret this, but they came around as soon as the evidence showed its head here pretty quickly that, wait a minute now, he is definitely in the circle. And I think that Agent Owens, who I've known, I think he's got the highest integrity. I think he had him in the circle from day one, but probably in the initial, and I haven't talked about this, but I'm assuming in the initial scene and going there, it was just unthinkable. How could he kill his son and his wife? So I think that might have been the setting.
And to dig deeper on this question in particular, I think we are at a point in this trial, from the outsider's perspective, you're not on the jury, you're not part of the prosecution, you're just an observer at this point. We're observers too. We're reporting what we see and trying to be as objective and as fair and balanced as we possibly can be in how we're reporting it and how we're analyzing it on platforms like this, where we're giving somewhat of our opinions. I think a lot of people's minds are made up and have been made up for a long time, and you will see what you want to see at a certain point, and check yourself. Realize that we all do it. We all have our biases. We all have our life experiences and our perceptions of things. And sometimes we believe what we want to believe. I would just be cautious of, to quote Waylon Jennings, be careful of something that's exactly what you want it to be. And that's something when you're consuming media as well. If you're being told exactly what you want to hear and it's affirming everything you already believe, that's a red flag. And I think just to be cautious in that when you're trying to form your own opinions in what you're hearing about this case and about these people involved and the facts as they are, take everything with a grain of salt. Don't take my word for it just because I'm from Walterboro or something like this, or take Charlie's word for it.
Take Charlie's word for it.
Please.
Take Charlie's word.
We do appreciate
off of it quickly.
We do appreciate you all tuning in and listening to us. And if we're not giving you that, like this specific question about, do we think that the Murdochs' influence could have played a role in this, and we're not harping on that point, it's because it's impossible for us to speculate on that point. And it would be unwise for us to speculate on that point. There certainly may be evidence to suggest that, if taken from a 3,000 feet in the air view, and you're looking back over a history of behavior and things like that with this family and others in the 14th Circuit and whatever. If you're looking for something like that, you're going to find it.
Right.
But it may not necessarily be there.
Yeah. Well, if you could step back too a little bit, I've sort of reflected on the last 5 or 6 weeks. I think it's sort of the majesty of the American legal system. Here you have the state of South Carolina putting in immense resources to bring, from their perspective, to bring to justice somebody who's extremely prominent. And I don't know, I thought stepping back from this is, wow. I mean, it wouldn't happen in many parts of the world, let's put it that way, where this would occur. And it's all done in open court. We get to talk about the pitfalls of what hasn't been done, free speech in this country. And this defendant has able counsel representing him. He's got a jury of his peers sitting there. And I thought, I think the system's working.
And I think it's absolutely fascinating to take us where we're going. We've got tomorrow, we expect the jury is going to be going at 9:30 in the morning to go visit the crime scene at Moselle. They will be accompanied by a small amount of the lawyers, from what I understand.
The judge is also going to be going.
This is going to be a very secure setting. We've already been told there's going to be high security with this. They will be coming back to the courthouse to get the closing arguments. Mm-hmm. We have closing arguments on both sides. They can also do two closing arguments, and you said...
Don't have time to talk about the law stuff here, but maybe we can save that. I don't know. But there's some interesting back and forth on jury charges, mm-hmm. on accomplice liability, and what's called mere presence. That's going to be tactically extremely important, I think, for both sides, and there'll be a discussion about that, I think, in open court. And that's...
But without the jury present.
Correct. I don't know if we have time to talk about this, but I think both sides have important decisions to make on how they want the judge to charge the law in South Carolina. And short comment, it is possible for the state to ask for what's called hand of one, hand of all, if they want to give credence to any degree to the defense that there must have been two shooters. Because it still can make Alec Murdoch guilty of murder if he is, the hand of one is the hand of all. If he's actively involved, it's called accomplice liability. That's the kind of short version that is typically used in both the charge and in the jury argument. But tactically, do they do that? Because it undercuts their theory of the case. But I'm thinking that it might be wise to do it because they had one expert that said there had to be two shooters. Fine, if you buy that argument, a little dig intended, right, because it's a paid expert. If you buy that one, fine. But he still was actively involved, so find him guilty. And the other sort of back and forth on this is defense, I would think, would ask for the judge to say, if the defendant's merely present, well-known law in South Carolina, but not actively involved, he's not guilty of anything, or murder, certainly. But you know, if you think of the testimony, he did testify that he wasn't there at the times of the murder. So the state can say, judge, the evidence doesn't warrant that mere presence charge because he himself says he wasn't there. But having said that, I think if they request it, I would think Judge Newman, in the interest of caution, would allow that charge to be had by the defense. So there'll be a fascinating back and forth on this. A little overview on the procedure, jury selection. I mean, jury visit tomorrow, they come back. I think we're going to have an open court discussion on jury charges. But then in South Carolina, the way this works is since the defense put in evidence, the state has to open fully on what's called the fully in the law and the facts. And so they have to discuss thoroughly their version of events, facts, and the applicable law fully. Now, that can be a bit of an argument on what's fully. And then the defense gives their full argument on law and facts. and the state's only allowed to reply to new information that the defense argues in their closing arguments. And you can imagine how that can be a little bit gray on what do you mean, new or not new. So I anticipate both sides will, which is a little bit unusual because it's considered a little bit discourteous, but I think you'll see some lawyers standing up during closing argument saying, "I object."
Oh, boy.
And we'll see how that goes, but that could get going a good bit potentially tomorrow afternoon.
This is all happening tomorrow. That's all I want to ask. Like, how in the world is this all going to happen tomorrow?
Judge Newman at the close of court did have, I thought, a very robust, optimistic schedule.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see how it can all be done in a day. I think we're going to bleed over until the day after tomorrow, but who knows?
Charlie, I have a question briefly. With this hand of one, hand of all charge, would that be something discussed in front of the jury as far as the charging deliberations?
Absolutely. Yeah, the tactical, first of all, does the state request it? Because that is a huge tactical decision. I'm confident you're discussing that. Hey, do we ask for that or not? Because it in a way, undercuts what they believe happened. You heard General Wilson say, our theory is one shooter. But I thought to myself, well, why not request it? Because they have an expert saying it, and just, I don't know, you talk to people, they have a hard time understanding how one person could have done it.
Right.
So to me, it allows any potential jurors that have some questions about it being one shooter a way to vote for guilty. And if I'm prosecuting, whether it's two shooters or one shooter, so long as I get a guilty verdict on murder, mission accomplished from my standpoint. But so the way that would work is they have to make the decision of whether to ask for it.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't ask for it, I'm confident Judge Newman won't give it on his own.
Well, would they be able to ask for it without outside of the jury's presence?
Because this is done.
I anticipate
without the jury being there, that we're going to have this interesting back and forth. Because I think Judge Newman, a lot of judges do this in chambers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not public, but I've noticed he has a huge preference for everything in public. Let's discuss it in public. They did have one visit today back in chambers, but I think that might have been unrelated on what we're talking about. I think it may have been related to some other issue. But so I think we'll have a fascinating back and forth about, maybe he said come back about 11 or so, which is before I think the jury gets back. So I think we'll hear that. So there'll be a decision on what he's going to charge. He'll tell them. And then they'll craft their arguments based upon the charge that they know is coming. And most lawyers think that it's good to quote in your closing arguments, give the law is going to be as Judge Newman gives it to you, but I believe he's going to tell you this. And if you have this parrot the same language as the judge gives to the jury charge, it's believed, which I think is true, that gives you credibility, like you're in the know with the judge.
Right. I'm just visualizing, I think, Judge Newman turning to that jury and introducing the idea of hand of one, hand of all to them and saying, ladies and gentlemen, you have heard testimony in this trial from an expert witness saying they believe that there were two shooters involved. I want to tell you now about the hand of one, hand of all theory, which says that anyone involved is guilty. I think that's a lot. There's no risk to the state if Judge Newman is the one introducing the idea to them. Because that makes it seem impartial but I guess that's where I'm just, do they have to make that call in front of the jury
No, they don't. They have to swallow their pride a bit though, right? Because I think they believe they've proven one shooter.
But how would the jury ever know where it came from?
True, but yeah. In other words, an opening statement, did Creighton Waters commit to one shooter?
He committed to Alec doing both.
Okay, so he did. So you have to swallow his pride a little bit on that. Say that, hey, there's been some testimony. If you want to believe that, you still can find him guilty. So I don't know. I'm very interested just from a legal standpoint whether they do it tomorrow or not. We'll find out.
Tomorrow we will find out a lot, and we'll see how long that day lasts. Just join us afterwards. We'll be here tomorrow night to tell you everything that we know. See what happens.
What some might say is not much, but we're trying.
But we'll tell you everything we know anyways. Yeah, that's right. Well, we'll see you tomorrow. Thank you so much for joining us. And be sure to send us questions if we didn't answer what you needed to hear. Thanks.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.